It will cause precarious businesses to go bankrupt and provoke mass unemployment. Data shows this is already taking place.
Corporate bankruptcies just hit their highest first half levels since 2010. Planned layoffs are at the highest first half levels since 2009. The damage done by prolonged high interest rates is revealed by the highest level in years for credit card, car loan, and other debt, and all while still failing to reduce record prices for the most basic goods.
People are suffering from it, and a lot of more people are going to food banks to get food because they can't afford to buy a lot of the food. And also the government has cut food subsidies for people who in need.
Despite the economic hardship, Washington has ended key coronavirus-era programs, with health insurance just revoked for millions of people. States are reporting their first increases in years for their poverty rates, all of which contributes to President Joe Biden's near-record-low approval rating.
Yeah, they might cause Biden to lose the election because he's not doing enough about inflation. I'm sure he knows that. I mean, people are going to, whatever, if it's going to be Trump versus Biden or whoever, people are going to vote for where the economic situation, where they think it's going to be better. Because most people see the two parties as being the same.
There are other ways to curb excessive prices that don't burden the working class, such as price controls, limiting corporate profits, preventing price gouging, and increasing wages. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
New long-range precision strike gear for Iran's naval forces. The Abu Mahdi naval cruise missiles give naval vessels of both the Army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps the capability to target hostile elements 1,000 kilometers away.
The mass production of the Abu Mahdi cruise missiles allows us to hit hostile targets kilometers away. Even moving targets approaching us from the sea can be hit from unknown locations.
Named after Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the senior commander of Iraq's popular mobilization forces, who was assassinated alongside top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in 2020, the Abu Mahdi class of cruise missiles is one of the latest products of Iran's aerospace industries to be delivered to the armed forces.
The missiles that we received today can be launched by different sea and land platforms toward designated targets and can also be used on our destroyers.
The fully homegrown naval cruise missiles are equipped with artificial intelligence, an important feature that increases Iran's capability to hit hostile targets with pinpoint precision.
The Abu Mahdi naval cruise missile has distinguishing features in terms of precision strikes and destructive power. Most importantly, it travels at low altitudes and it is therefore capable of radar evading maneuvers.
This is all in line with Iran's defense doctrine, emphasizing that peace and security in the region should be achieved only by regional countries.
The message that this new addition to our arsenal sends to the world is that the Islamic Republic of Iran attaches great importance to maritime security. That is mainly because security in our region can affect major business and economic transactions on a global scale.
The new naval cruise missiles immensely expand Iran's naval defense coverage zone and allow naval units to broaden their operational range.
The fully homegrown Abu Mahdi long-range cruise missile once again puts the spotlight on Iran's defense capabilities, as the Islamic Republic of Iran plays an important role in providing peace and security in the region. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Verses from the Holy Quran decorated the streets of the Yemeni capital, where Yemenis showed their anger and condemnation at yet another act of desecration of the Holy Quran in Denmark. Ansarullah officials who spoke at the rally announced that any actions aimed at insulting Islam will be met with severe consequences against perpetrators.
Their continuous desecration of the Quran indicates how they underestimate the Muslim world's power, and the reason they continue to insult us is because of Arab regimes' weakness. These regimes refuse to mobilize to protect Islam and our holy book, Quran.
In a time when Arab regimes remain silent and normalize relations with the Zionist entity, the Yemeni people came out to declare their unwavering support for the Book of God and to condemn these actions that aim to attack the spirit of our faith. Yemeni people will always be at the forefront of protecting Islam.
According to protesters, the burning of the Quran in the West is not accidental. They believe that the American Zionist lobby is behind these actions. Additionally, they believe the West, led by the U.S., is hell-bent on spreading its corrupt, godless ideology throughout the Muslim world.
We call on all Muslims to come out and protect Islam and no longer remain silent. No doubt, it is the American Zionist lobby that controls all European nations who are behind this. They target our Islamic morals and principles. These actions, however, will only strengthen our determination to protect our religion.
Last week, Yemen became the first Islamic nation to impose a ban on all Swedish products following the desecration of Quran in Stockholm last month. It remains to be seen whether the Yemeni government will ban Danish products. Another Quran burning incident has taken place in another Western country where Islamophobia is on the rise. As expected, the Muslim world has come out to condemn the move. But as history has proven, condemning the act will simply not stop the repetition of such sacrilegious moves. These protesters say more needs to be done to protect Islam. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Representatives of religious minorities have met in the Iranian capital Tehran to condemn the desecration of Muslims' holy book, Quran, saying that such a sacrilegious act is aimed at creating discord and division among followers of different religious beliefs. They condemned repeated desecrations of the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in Sweden, noting that the Swedish government is fully responsible for the consequences of provoking the sentiments of the Muslim world.
Such insults to Islamic sanctities are a perfect example of organized violence in a hostile move against 2 billion Muslims across the world, God-believing people and followers of divine religions. Desecration of religious sanctities is rejected in all faiths. The recent desecrations in Sweden is considered a heinous crime and is unacceptable.
The recurring incidents of the desecration of Islamic sanctities in Europe, particularly in Sweden and Denmark, have drawn outrage across the Muslim world in recent weeks, especially here in Iran. In the Iranian capital Tehran, demonstrators gathered in front of the Swedish embassy to protest against the sacrilegious move. Moreover, millions of people took to the streets in Tehran and other major cities after Friday prayers this week to voice their anger over the incidents in Sweden and Denmark.
The sinister plot hatched by the enemies of Islam is not limited only to this period of time. The enemies of divine religions have always tried to sow the seeds of discord among their followers. But they should know that followers of Islam and other divine religions are vigilant and will not allow such insulting acts to create division and discord among them, and they get even more united in the face of the enemies.
Any insult to religious sanctities and divine books anywhere by anyone is deplorable. Any freedom of speech which is meant to violate the dignity, values, and religious sanctities of good and God-loving people is not freedom of speech and has no value and is strongly condemned.
Muslim protesters have demanded punishment for the perpetrators, calling for the boycott of Swedish and Danish products. Representatives of divine religions here believe that branding such moves as acts of democracy and freedom will only further fuel terrorism and extremism across the world, the consequences of which will boomerang on the West before any other side. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Handcuffed and humiliated before her child for the offense she didn't commit. A black woman arrested for what the Metropolitan Police in London suspected was a bus fare evasion. They were wrong. She was released. What ensued? Widespread outrage from the public and politicians. Claudia Webb, MP, said the Met Police is the boot of the state. They do not care about black people and black women in particular. The incident has reignited national conversations about institutional racism and misogyny within the British police force, a force grappling with a crisis of confidence. Revelations of criminals within its ranks, including Wayne Cousins, who abducted, raped, and murdered Sarah Everard as she was walking home nearly 2 years ago, and David Carrick, who admitted to dozens of sexual offenses against 12 women, have shaken faith in the force.
Policing in the UK relies on public consent and trust, but confidence in the police has been in decline in the past few years, especially when it comes to racism against minorities and violence against women and girls. And with the continuing disclosures of members of the police found guilty in those crimes, it's only exposing how deep the problems run.
Of all minority communities, black Britons say they feel the least safe at the hands of British police. The strip search of Child Q, a black 15-year-old girl suspected of having marijuana at a London school in 2020 by two female officers without another adult present, and the police killing of Chris Baba last September, a 24-year-old father and aspiring rapper, are two recent examples.
This case of this young mother with a child is actually symptomatic of the degree of systemic and culturally ingrained racism within the Metropolitan Police Service. And it's a tale that I hear from black mothers all over the city consistently about their unprofessional, violent, and sometimes racist treatment at the hands of them and their children at the hands of the Metropolitan Police Service.
Black children are 11 times more likely to be strip searched in England and Wales than their white peers. And more than half stopped and searched by the police say they were left with feelings of humiliation or embarrassment.
Trauma is a real lived and everyday experience for black people in terms of their relationship with policing, whether it's stop and search, whether it's violent arrest. Again, by the Met's own standards, the Home Office's own figures, you're more likely to be stop and searched, you're more likely to be violent arrested. And what we find is the trauma that's inflicted on the individuals in communities is completely unrecognized and ignored.
Restoring trust would be a massive undertaking. Some are calling for the force to be disbanded in the wake of the recent scandals. Others say the promised overhaul of the UK's entire police culture may be just one step to restore some measure of faith in the force. Saeed Poreza, London.
Votes in the House of Lords, the migration bill is set to become law in the United Kingdom, enabling the Home Office to detain and remove anyone entering the country to seek asylum. They could also be transported to Rwanda or a third country under the plan. The UK struck an initial £140 million agreement with the East African country this year, but the plan has been stuck in the courts. Former British Prime Minister Theresa May has slammed what critics call the Illegal Migration Bill, or IMB, saying it will consign more people to slavery.
It will enable more slave drivers to operate and make money out of human misery. It will consign more people to slavery.
The United Nations has also lambasted the new legislation and warned that it's against international law.
The bill is at variance with the country's obligations under international human rights and refugee law and will have profound consequences for people in need of international protection.
The UN also raised concerns about other countries following suit. UN refugee and human rights experts believe the IMB will exacerbate the already vulnerable situation of refugees across the UK. The No Accommodation Network, which represents a network of over 140 organisations and charities across the UK, called the passing of the bill shameful.
Whilst not unexpected, the passing of the Illegal Migration Bill marks a profoundly shameful and damaging moment for refugee protection and human rights in the UK.
Just hours after the UK passed the controversial bill, a so-called accommodation barge arrived in Portland Port, Dorset. It's due to house 500 asylum seekers, twice the number of people that it was designed for, raising doubts about its safety.
It has drawn strong condemnation from different groups and organizations worldwide, with many describing it as a floating prison. Delivering a speech in Westminster, Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper called the new IMB law a con and the use of barges as a sign of the Conservatives' total failure to clear the asylum backlog. A recent poll by YouGov reveals Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's rapidly falling favourability rating, which has sunk to its lowest level to date. In spite of protests and concerns over the anti-refugee plan, the government is adamant that it's the right move. According to official figures, more than 45,000 people were detected arriving by small boats in 2022, 60% higher than in 2021. Now, with the new bill, British authorities have the green light to indiscriminately remove asylum seekers, regardless of whether they are at a risk of persecution, have suffered human rights violations, or are survivors of human trafficking.
The people of Pakistan have held countrywide protests to voice their anger at the recent act of desecration of the Quran in Sweden. In less than a month, an Iraqi refugee in Stockholm committed the sacrilegious act twice while protected by Swedish police. The protesters called on the Islamic world to cut ties with Sweden and to expel its ambassadors from their respective countries.
Muslim nations should check out a comprehensive line of action to end such sacrilegious acts. We will continue our fight for the sanctity of our holy book.
In Europe, where you cannot talk about the Holocaust, burning the Quran is freedom of expression. This is the double standard of Europe. Such hate acts should be stopped.
Meanwhile, religio-political groups in Pakistan also demanded cutting off all diplomatic relations with Sweden, while urging the United Nations to legislate against the desecration of holy books, including the Quran.
Quran was desecrated from the second time in Sweden with the permission of the government. What freedom of expression is this? Global colonialist forces are behind this conspiracy, and the anti-Islam actors of Europe are involved in this insult.
While denouncing the incident, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif pledged to launch a campaign to end the blasphemy of holy books in the Nordic state. He said that his government would help create a common strategy to eliminate Islamophobia with the help of Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
Muslims around the world have been outraged by the repeated desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden in recent months. They are all in unison that these incidents are blatant provocation, attempting to inflame sentiments and undermine Islam as a religion. Nasrik Azmi, Islamabad.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Ukraine is raging on. Ukraine is using U.S. cluster munitions for the first time. Although it's too early to assess its success, this is not seen as a game changer. Meanwhile, Russia has been bombing Ukraine relentlessly, hitting food supply centers. Why isn't Russia winning the war? And why is Ukraine being provided with military assets, which amount to only making moderate gains? The EU has also made a major announcement that it will provide Ukraine with 22 billion euros for the next 5 years, which risks prolonging the war. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Edward Lozansky, president of the World Russia Forum, joins us from Washington, D.C. And Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Welcome to you both. Edward Lozansky, let me first start with you, if I may. Let's go on to the first, alarming use of weapons called cluster munitions that the U.S. has provided Ukraine. And we understand that they are now being used on the battlefield. Of course, we need to also say that Ukraine has accused Russia of using the same type of munitions. What is the success rate of these cluster munitions that Ukraine is using? Correct me if I'm wrong, it's just, contributes to some killings on the battlefield, but not much more than that, if I'm correct to look at it that way.
Well, not just on the battlefield, it kills civilians.
And today, actually, it killed a Russian reporter and injured four. But you're right, it's not really a game changer. It simply continues and suffering for Ukrainians and for Russians. And the reason why I think, at least how the Washington explains, that they really are running out of regular ammunition, and then the only thing left is those cluster bombs, which is a kind of a violation of international law. But who cares? International law, you know, it was violated already many times, you know, in the Middle East, of course, in Iraq and Syria, Libya, and other wars. So it's sad. It's a sad story, because the only thing that could avoid this war from the beginning, it was if Ukraine would have a neutral status. It was so simple, because if Ukraine will accept this neutral status, then it will benefit. It can be friends with the West, with the United States, Europe, all over the world, including Russia, which is, has you know, strong ties. They live together like over three centuries. So, well, it's the West, now it's called Collective West, decides that instead of allowing Ukraine, which most of the Ukrainian people wanted this neutral, majority of Ukrainians wanted this neutral status, but they were not allowed, but the elites who sold out.
A majority of Ukrainians wanted what? I didn't catch that. I'm sorry.
They wanted to have neutral status. They didn't want to join NATO. When there were all opinion polls before 2014, they were saying that the majority of Ukrainians don't want to join NATO. But you know, that's why there was a coup, and the coup, okay, which brought a new government, which declared that they want to join NATO. And sure. That's the main reason for the war.
All right. We'll expand on that a little bit later, hopefully. I'd like to just find out from you, Dalia Kovalik, the use of cluster munitions. You know, you have at this point, as our guests are indicated, a Russian war reporter was killed, four were wounded, which was basically through the use of these U.S.-provided cluster munitions. When it comes to the point of whether this was provided because Ukraine had no ammo, it really puts or sheds another light onto this whole scenario. If it doesn't have ammo, why is it being provided with cluster munitions? And the mere fact that there's a shortage of ammo, what does that say about the war and the support that it's getting?
Well, President Biden made it clear that the cluster munitions were being sent as a stopgap measure because the U.S. had run out of other munitions. So, yes, NATO is running out of munitions. I mean, that's why Ukraine's running out of munitions, right? It says a lot. It says that Russia is burning through the West military supply, which is pretty profound. Meanwhile, Russia seems to be able to keep up with, you know, producing its own munitions. So it certainly means that Ukraine and the West are losing this war, but the West is doing anything it can to keep the war continuing, to keep it prolonged in order to try to damage Russia. And so, yeah, now Biden's even resorted to sending these cluster munitions, even though Obama had decided to stop, you know, providing countries with those because of international law concerns. But, you know, as our colleague said, who cares? I mean, sadly, liberals in the U.S. who used to care about these things don't care about these things anymore, don't care about war and peace, don't care about cluster bombs, don't care about the possibility of nuclear war. So this thing continues to escalate. And the use of these weapons is definitely an escalation of the conflict. And the fact they're being used in mainland Russia, you know, in Belgorod against Russians, is quite significant. You know, the problem with cluster munitions, amongst many others, is that a significant percentage of them do not go off immediately, which means they just sit somewhere. And someone years from now will come along, maybe a child, and hit it and be killed or maimed. And, you know, that's what makes it really an indiscriminate military device and what makes it in violation of international humanitarian law.
Okay. There's been a lot of speculation, which I'd like to find out from you whether what you think is the case, and that is how Russia is targeting these food storage facilities of Ukraine. One scenario that is being put out there is the fact that Russia wants to use food as a weapon of war, and this is its way of doing it. It stopped, the supply, as we're well aware of that. Edward Lozansky, what is Russia's goal there? Do you think that it's using food as a weapon of war?
Well, first of all, as so far as I know, Russia is not bombing those food supplies, storage. It's bombing the infrastructure of the ports in Odessa and other cities. Not direct hit of the grain. In terms of using grain as a weapon, or food as a weapon, it's not so, because Russia is ready to provide this food, even for free, some, not all, but for example, some fertilizers to poor stations, poor nations. It's willing to provide it for free, it's ready to do it. But the thing is that it's under sanctions, and the deal which was made with the help of the United Nations, that as long as this food supplies through Black Sea will go on, some sanctions for Russian food supplies will be lifted, which didn't happen. Also, it was Ukraine used those some of the tankers to ship weapons. Actually, one of the tankers was used to now inflict damage on the Crimean bridge. So this is what Kremlin and Putin are saying, that Russia is ready to provide this grain, Ukraine can do the same as long as the deal which was made with the help of the nations is honored. But the deal was not honored.
Okay, thank you so much for clarifying the fact that it was the infrastructure that was targeted and not the facility itself. Well, let's take a look at something that may be a game changer. And it's still such a perplexing notion of the U.S. perspective, I should say, Daniel Kovalik, as to the way that they've been providing arms and military assets to Ukraine. There was a very worrying piece of news that came from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, and it read as follows: White House's Sullivan, whether or not we give ATACMs to Ukraine is a decision to be made by the president. Now, these are tactical ballistic missiles that's manufactured by Lockheed Martin. Could this be a game changer? Because these are long-range missiles, and of course we know what that means. And if it is something that's being contemplated, and the U.S. president is going to say yes or no to it, of which he has said yes now to almost everything, I think at this point the F-16s or the fighter jets and this ATACMs are left. What do you think would happen? Is that a prelude to World War III?
It certainly could be, yeah. I mean, we could be looking at some sort of major conflagration in Europe, and yeah, possibly an exchange of nuclear weapons. This is a very dangerous move. Biden knows that, by the way. He's mentioned in the past, if you send those types of weapons, that's World War III, right? And he wouldn't do it. Well, now he's decided. He keeps changing his own red lines. He keeps moving them all forward or backward, however you look at it, and removing those red lines. And deciding to send weapons he formerly said would cause World War III, and he doesn't seem to care about that now. You know, he seems to be willing to do anything to prolong this war in order to, one, weaken Russia, and two, let's face it, to try to win the 2024 election that's quickly approaching. I think he's made the calculus that if Russia wins this war before the election, that he'll lose, and he's willing to keep it going to try to win, and he's willing to keep it going even if it means nuclear war. And I can't think of a more reprehensible decision to make.
Edward Lozansky, we have heard so much about the gains and losses on the battlefield. On the one hand, let me ask you about what Putin has said, and he has said this a number of occasions, that Ukraine has lost tens of thousands of soldiers. First of all, my question to you is, if Ukraine is losing so badly, why isn't Russia defeating Ukraine?
I think that Russia is using only limited resources, because Putin and actually a majority of Russians feel that Ukrainians are our people. We are the same. We lived together for over three centuries. We have our not just economy and joint and culture, religion, by the way, which is very important. Both countries, majority are Orthodox, Slavic Orthodox, and families. So a lot of families are mixed with Russian and Ukrainian spouses. So I think this is all taken into account. That just feel the Russians feel that they just cannot use all this enormous force that they have to kill their own. So it's a sad story that. That Russians, Ukrainians are killing each other. But I think in one of my kind of articles, actually in American media, I printed out that what's going on now is worse than Vietnam and Iraq and the other wars in the Middle East, because over there, American soldiers were fighting and dying. But now Ukraine is used like a mercenary country. The whole country became a country of mercenaries. And they're fighting war, not their war. They're fighting war for the United States, for the collective West, which wants to defeat and impose a strategic defeat for Russia. So I'm really sorry for my fellow Ukrainians. I myself was born in Ukraine, and I have a lot of relatives and friends in Ukraine. And now my fellow Ukrainians are used as cannon fodder. It's horrible.
Well, I'm trying to figure out the strategy that Ukraine has, Daniel Kovalik. I'm not a military strategist. Maybe I can get help from you. When you take a look at the way that Ukraine is fighting, it seems like they're just warding off or they're repelling the attacks by Russia. And that's the best case scenario. Advances are so minimal. Even not only has Ukraine said that, President Zelensky, but also the U.S., a variety of officials have come forward saying that the gains on the ground are very minimal, if any. So, you know, what's the use of this war if it's just to repel or to stand up to Russia, but not to win the war and to beat Russia?
Well, Ukraine does not have a strategy, and it certainly doesn't have a strategy of its own. You know, the U.S. is calling the shots on this, and the U.S., its goal is to prolong the war, not necessarily to win it. They want to prolong it in order to weaken Russia in the same way that Afghanistan was used in the 80s to weaken the Soviet Union. They want to try to use this war to drain Russia economically and militarily, to try to destabilize Russia. And so Ukraine is just being used as a tool for that. Their soldiers are just being used as fodder for this, because that's what the U.S. wants. And the Ukrainian leadership does not have the interest of Ukraine or the Ukrainian people at heart. They are simply using this war to line their own pockets. We know from the CIA that, when this is from a few months ago, that even by that time, Zelensky's folks had stolen about $400 million, it was at least, from the aid being sent to Ukraine. You know, Zelensky and his people, their goal is to do whatever the U.S. wants. And then when this is over, their hope is that they'll move to Miami or the Bahamas with billions of dollars and be happy. The fact they leave their country in ruins and their country people dead seems of no consequence to them.
Yeah, we could talk about the corruption. As you mentioned, it did come out in the news a few months ago. And Ukraine is categorized to be a very corrupt country. But unfortunately, we have a few other more important pieces of facts here that we need to discuss. Edward Luzanski, this plan that has been drawn up by the EU, which has raised a lot of eyebrows as to what is behind it, and that's the $22 billion, as Joseph Borrell called, a weapons fund to provide Ukraine with weapons and military aid over the course of 4 years. What do you make of it? I mean, on the one hand, some are saying this will prolong the war. On the other hand, is what that security guarantee that Zelensky was looking for. What do you think it is?
Well, EU leadership It's not just the word vessels, which are using oil more and more often. I recall that in 2007, when Putin spoke to the Munich Security Conference, he first used this word. He said, "We want to be American friends, and even allies." America doesn't need friends. America needs only vassals. So Europe, EU, this is now a country of vassals. They keep pushing, giving this money to Ukraine when their own people are suffering. Look at what's going on in Britain now with all the strikes and underpaid medical personnel and what was happening in France and in other countries. So they betrayed their own people. So this is horrible. And talking about corruption, it's not just only corruption in Ukraine, it's corruption in Washington. What's going on now, when more and more facts, whistleblowers are coming out and saying that President Biden is corrupt, that he was using Ukraine as a moneymaker. He installed his son on this corrupt company, Burisma, and Burisma paid him bribes. And this is open, it's in Congress. So can you imagine, they keep talking about values, democracy, freedom, that their own president is corrupt and he probably has to be impeached.
What do you think about that, Kovalik?
I agree. I think Biden should be impeached. I think he is waging a war in part to cover his own corruption, which is, again, horrifying, absolutely horrifying. And sadly, the U.S. press has covered up this corruption, but as my colleague has said, the truth is coming out, as it always will. But for a president to use a war to deal with his own individual corruption is something that should never happen. He has betrayed the American people. He has betrayed the Ukrainian people in doing this. He is risking a nuclear war, again, to deal with his own personal misdeeds. I can't think of a worse thing to do. I can't think of a worse president, to be honest. I hope the American people wake up in time to stop this.
If I can add to what just
sure, go ahead.
That the guy with the name Kennedy, he keeps saying exactly the same what we are saying. Kennedy is Democrat. No, he is son of Robert Kennedy, who was killed, and the nephew of John Kennedy. He's saying exactly that. He's saying that Biden is pushing us to nuclear war, and Tulsi Gabbard, she was also running for president for the Democratic Party. She says exactly. So even Democrats are turning against Biden. I think he has to be impeached as soon as possible, and maybe a new president will stop this horror.
All right. My final question goes to you, Daniel Kovalik. We talked about the long-range missiles. We talked about one thing we didn't talk about is how there were 3,000 more U.S. Marines, I believe, or soldiers were sent, 3,000 troops, reservists, were sent to Europe, which puts the number at over 100,000, which is for the first time since the year 2005. Given all that, are we looking at a more or a thought behind these actions that the U.S. may be thinking of upping the ante in terms of a direct conflict with Russia through NATO, maybe?
I mean, absolutely. I think there are people in Washington who want that, who believe they had hoped, let's face it, they hoped that the economic sanctions against Russia would have weakened, if not destroyed, Russia. It did not. Russia's doing fine. They had prepared for those sanctions. The war is not destroying Russia. So now I think there are people who feel like NATO has to be more directly involved to defeat Russia. And that's the name of the game here. And yes, I do think the sending of these troops is a sign that there is a move in that direction to have a direct confrontation with Russia. And again, this should be horrifying to anyone in the world, certainly to Americans who need to hold their government accountable for this.
Thank you very much for that. Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law from Pittsburgh, PA. Edward Lazowski, thank you. President of the World Russia Forum from Washington, D.C. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Rida, peace be upon him, has said, "If you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous."
In the limelight.
According to the Gaza Ministry of Social Development, 459 families were displaced as a result of the Israeli regime war. They are now homeless, totaling 2,516 people, including 1,180 children. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "On May 9th, the Zionist regime attacked Gaza with ferocity. For 5 days, it bombed the besieged Gaza Strip, killing 33 Palestinians and wounding hundreds more. Much of that horror, however, was not shown on television, especially in Western media. On May 13, 2023, the Naphan family received a phone call from the Zionist regime army, warning them of an imminent bombing of their residence, located in the neighborhood of Jabalia, in the besieged Gaza Strip. Falestine and Bilal Naphan are both 35. They have 4 children with special needs. That harrowing call terrorized them. Falestine told the Palestine Chronicle, "We were having dinner when the Israeli army called us and ordered us to evacuate our house in 10 minutes. Falestine continued, "Gripped by fear, I hastily dressed myself on the staircase. I also forgot to wear my hijab." Her husband Bilal told us that his first thoughts were focused only on the children. He said, "We only had 10 minutes to leave our house. Even for a healthy person, this is hardly enough. Imagine for a person with disabilities. I was not even able to take their medications and wheelchairs with me." Bilal said, "But the sadness of that moment is still lingering." The Naphan family's house, once filled with cherished memories, now lies in ruins. The family is now homeless. Palestine told us in tears, "Where can we seek refuge? My disabled children did not deserve such a fate." The Naphan family remains without shelter, since none of their relatives' houses could accommodate their large number. The Banat family also fell victim to the devastating 5-day Israeli regime attack on May 9th, which destroyed their 3-story home. Faraj Banat, 38, is a father of 6. During the latest war, he was at the funeral of a relative when he received a call from the Israeli regime army. "I received a call from an Israeli intelligence officer. He ordered me to return home, and he told me that he could see I was at a graveyard," Banat told the Palestine Chronicle. Banat told the officer that he is a simple farmer with no connection to any resistance movement. The Israeli regime officer, however, was adamant. He said, "Go back and evacuate your family within 10 minutes." Banat requested more time to gather his belongings or clothes before the bombing, but the Israeli regime officer refused. Then the Israeli regime officer asked him to warn his neighbors because they intended to target the entire square, a reference to the whole block of houses. The officer told Banat, "I will bomb your house and your two brothers' houses." The Israeli voice on the phone seemed bereft of any humanity. The house, in fact, all the houses were destroyed as promised by the Zionist regime officer. Banat said, "More than 10 families are now displaced. Why did they bomb any house? My house? Other people's houses? Where should we live now?" Their financial situation does not allow the Banat family to find an alternative housing solution. Therefore, the family is now living in a tent in front of their demolished home. In Beit Lahia, in the northern Gaza Strip, another family is experiencing similar trauma. On May 12th, two Israeli regime F-16 destroyed a building belonging to the Taha family. In fact, this is not the first time the family loses their home due to the Israeli regime bombing. Samir Taha, 62, told the Palestine Chronicle, "During the 2014 attack on Gaza, they bombed my home. Our family remained homeless for 2 days before we could rebuild our home. And now, after all of that suffering, the Israeli regime occupation bombed our home again." Samir's son, Mohammad, told us that they were also warned 10 minutes before the bombardment to evacuate. Mohammad said, "More than 42 people lived in this building. We began running outside without taking anything. This is not humane." The Taha family plans to set up a tent in the proximity of their home until they are able to rebuild. Mohammad said, "Unfortunately, the tent does not protect us from cold and heat, nor is it able to protect us from stray dogs, but we have no alternative. I grew up in this home, I lived here and got married in it, but all our memories are lost now." In its continued attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime destroyed civilian infrastructure, buildings, and entire residential neighborhoods. Various international human rights organizations said that the Israeli regime has committed what amounts to war crimes. But this is what human rights experts often say. It neither prevented the Zionist regime from attacking and killing Palestinians, nor provided Palestinian victims with any justice or even shelter. Wafa News Agency also reported, according to the Gaza Ministry of Social Development, 459 families were displaced in the recent Israeli regime war. And according to these statistics, they are now homeless, totaling 2,516 people, including 1,180 children.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.